Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts on the channel. And I am joined today by Gordon Barrett to talk about his new book, China's Cold War Science Diplomacy. Welcome to New Books, Gordon, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Great. So why don't we start at the beginning with your beginning? So how did you come to work on Chinese history and modern Chinese history in particular?
Sure. Well, it seems to happen so much in my academic career. It came by accident. I went to a small liberal arts university and took a variety of history courses, including some Chinese history, but actually ended up specializing in, of all things, 20th century Atlantic Canadian history. But there was a summer study program that they offered in China at Zhejiang University, and there were worse places to spend a summer than Hangzhou. And so that kind of set something, I guess, a hair running. And I partly mentioned that because, so I went on and did a master's in Chinese studies that was partly designed to kind of for people who wanted to transition toward looking at China in their work. And I got very, very lucky in terms of where things intersected with this project, in fact, because I've been very fortunate in terms of supervisors, undergraduate, master's and doctoral. And my master's supervisor knew that I had this interest in Atlantic Canadian history and kind of said to me, so have you thought about looking at China and Pugwash? Because there's some really fun documents at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs archives that I think you'd really enjoy based on your interests and kind of digging into. And that I realized very quickly actually was going to be too big a project that I wanted to do for a master's thesis. And so I decided to put it in my back pocket and develop it further. And then I got lucky just in the year between that and starting my doctorate, I got to spend a year again at Zheda on the Canada-China Scholars Exchange Program. And getting to spend some, as it turns out, again, very fortunately, time in the archive before my degree kind of formally got started and kind of hit the ground running and realized, ooh, actually, there's a lot more to this that I want to explore.
So I'm always thrilled for personal reasons when Canada comes up. That's very exciting to me. And actually, there is a lot, as you mentioned, Pugwash of Canada in this book, surprisingly. again, for personal reasons, I am always very excited when Canada emerges over the course of these conversations. But we're definitely going to be returning to Nova Scotia and Pugwash in particular later as it features so prominently in the book. But as you said, there was a lot of the book in your answer. So why don't we move to the book itself? So this book is, as you say in the introduction, it examines the strategies and structures that supported China's scientific outreach during the first decades of the Cold War. It shows how eminent Chinese scientists became interlocutors for the early PRC, particularly through their engagement in a cluster of international organizations and networks. And you focus specifically on CCP-supported scientific diplomacy from the 1940s through the early 1970s. And that's a really interesting time period and, you know, a relatively understudied period, especially in terms of science. And it's really not a period of time that has been thought of as one where China has a lot of global reach or influence. That, you know, that story really starts in the 70s. And as you say in the conclusion, actually, but I'll bring it up here, Mao's China was isolated from international science, or so the story used to go. And your book sort of really wonderfully calls that into question. But as a way of sort of situating this book and where it sits in the field, could you talk a little bit about this? You know, what does the story of Mao's China being isolated from international science, what does that story look like? And, you know, where did that come from? Why do we tell that story?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different reasons. And again, some of them are quite tightly tied to kind of the motivations for undertaking the project. One of the things that I'd say in the scholarship, of course, is I'm not the first person who's kind of looked at internationalized science in this period, whether it's Zhou Yuwang, Fatih Fan, Sigurd Schmaltzer, Arunabh Ghosh. There are a number of other people who are looking at this in a variety of ways. And I think one of the key things about the 70s is there's that key moment, the kind of key episode that, especially if, again, people who use the term science diplomacy and so on point to about the importance of scientific exchange in rapprochement, Sino-American rapprochement. And as a part of that, I'd say it kind of has led to the US context and Sino-American relations playing, I would argue, possibly a slightly outsized element in terms of how things are viewed retrospectively. So because there were travel restrictions before then and that kind of thing for Americans and vice versa, that there is this really very visibly transformative event in the 70s. But there's, of course, a kind of prehistory to all of this that plays on, I think, that touches on both the gray areas between, you know, what is political outreach and propaganda and then what is scientific exchange. And, of course, it's kind of all of the above at the same time. So, again, I think it's a question of one of the ways I started was thinking about, well, okay, where do we look for this, and what will it look like if we find it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely, and you know, with that, in that sort of, you know, intermingling the combination of the two, that, you know, at the heart of that, especially in your book, are scientists, I suppose. You know, you show, you know, China being interested in global international affairs and international science, and scientists sort of, you know, doing that work. They are really at the front of the CCP's, you know, party state supported international outreach arm, if you like. Or to put it in the CCP's term, these scientists are engaged in united front work. And that's it's such an important sort of concept and, you know, work through your book. So could you introduce this a little bit for listeners? You know, what is united front work and how did it manifest in the realm of science?
Sure. So united front work, I mean, maybe in its most basic terms, is it's really about building coalitions, right, of support, increasing influence among, again, in my particular interest, networks, organizations. And really, there's a kind of interest to here in co-opting these in a really an instrumental way in support of party aims and party goals and interests. And it's hugely important, not just in the CCP's rise to power but also in its long-term approach to governance and in foreign relations. Now, one of the reasons that I was particularly interested in scientists, again, I think maybe one of my key interests, I'd say probably that runs through a lot of the work that I've done, is interest in scientists as kind of political actors and how also science and ideology interact. And in this case, one of the things that really struck me as I was getting into the project that kind of was one of the hooks for me was we've got, again, a wonderful and broadening literature on Chinese foreign relations, particularly during the period that my book covers, with the kind of broad left more generally, right? And one, the two things that it kind of leapt out at me is that on the one hand, when scientists appeared, they were kind of mushed in with other leftist visitors or that kind of thing. And then at the same time, of course, there's this fantastic literature coming out, particularly from the history of science, technology and medicine, about transnational scientific networks and the ways in which scientists and self-identification and narration kind of play various roles in enmeshing them in political and activist activities, in particularly in the Cold War context. And so my interest was kind of saying, okay, well, what happens in the Chinese case? How does this manifest in the Chinese case? And as it became pretty evident to me that actually there are a number of key scientists, again, who are kind of major characters in the book, who are very heavily involved in these kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, foreign visitors a little bit there, and this is sort of, this will take us, we'll jump back, but that's sort of touching on something I think we'll get to over the course of our conversation. But we do have a chapter specifically on those visitors, and it's a really interesting chapter in that you look at these different scientists, and each one of them is sort of dealing with that tension of being, or actively, some of them are actively taking a role in the, more on the political side or more of the science side, but they're really interesting in how each of them is sort of, doing something a little different, I suppose, in sort of straddling that divide. So I just want to mark that. We will get to it, but they're coming, the visiting scientists.
And actually, I might just add one other thing to that, which you bring up is, again, one of the other things I was interested in was focusing primarily, that chapter coming as the last chapter was very intentional on my part. The last two chapters about people coming to the PRC, because one of the, again, the things that I was interested in exploring is what does the outward facing, the kind of international activities and mobility of Chinese scientists going out there and not just people coming there. That was one of the things that I was very keen to kind of explore in
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we will definitely get to talk about some of those Chinese scientists here as well. But before we get into the chapters, I did want to just touch on sources because this sort of, pulls us away from the book a little bit. But as you hint at in the introduction, this book is really made up of sort of fragmentary material. And, you've put together this really beautiful mosaic, as you sort of term it in the introduction. And there are glimpses of this, in the chapters themselves. But sort of before we dive in, could you give, myself and listeners a little bit of a sense of this? What kind of, sources were you drawing on? What did, doing the research for this book sort of look like? Sure. What was that experience like for you?
Variable across the period. So I mentioned that I was quite fortunate to have got to spend a good chunk of time in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs archive before I started my doctorate. And the reason I say that was fortunate is that access to archives broadly in China, but also specifically the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, let's just say, changed dramatically across the course of it, which actually, in my particular case, I think actually led to a more interesting project, if I'm being fully honest, because it kind of pushed me to think about some other things that, as the project had started, I was going to be mostly based at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I'd say that that probably is still the core material that kind of everything else is built on. But also, I ended up exploring municipal archives, material in municipal archives in Beijing and Shanghai in particular, but also scientists' personal papers, some organizational archives, for example, that of the World Federation of Scientific Workers. And then also, so coverage of activities, these types of exchange activities or propaganda activities, however you want to frame them, in academic journals, newsletters, magazines, newspapers in China and abroad, basically almost anything I could get my hands on that referred to these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of there's a great attention paid to sort of how some of these events were covered. So I just want to mark that. I don't think we're going to dive into that too much, but that was one of the most interesting parts for me, was reading sort of the coverage, both the events and the details and what happened and where and who paid for it, but also then how is it reported on? Just made for a really interesting part of the book itself. So I can't say that I'm thrilled that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was closed for you, or that access was difficult. But as you say, it led in some really interesting directions for sure.
It did, and as I say, I think working in the archive was interesting because I was there when it was kind of fully open, and then in the period when about 90% of the material was unavailable, but there was still some fascinating material that was amongst them still there. So it's been an interesting process.
Why don't we dive then to look at the results of that interesting process to segue us into this. So chapter one. So chapter one, I'll just sort of give a brief summary of it, sort of looks at the evolution of CCP support for the involvement of Chinese scientists in international scientific organizations. So you begin this chapter actually by talking a little bit about the Republican period. So you look at the Chinese Association of Scientific Workers, which was created in 1945. And you touch on a little bit here that this sort of, it did open branches in cities that were held by the Kuomintang, but the CCP were also involved and interested. So we have this organization, but then we sort of move to look at the World Federation of Scientific Workers, an international organization, and you point out that scientists associated with the Chinese Association of Scientific Workers were involved with the WFSW from the beginning, that they were, they were elected to prominent positions in the WFSW. But then after 1949, things really ramp up. So CCP leaders are acutely very interested in being involved in international scientific organizations, to the dismay, I suppose, of French and British governments. And you show how they yes. sort of subtly tried to block China, from being actively involved in particular sort of key moments. So this part of the chapter, it covers a number of different meetings of the WFSW. So you look at, who was involved, who attended, who paid for it. There's a lot of talk about money, where the meeting was held. But out of all these different meetings, is there maybe one in particular that you want to sort of highlight, one that really, encapsulates the kind of engagement that the PRC wanted to have or was trying to have with the Federation?
So, I mean, in some ways, the obvious one might be to say the 1956 Executive Council meeting that was held in Beijing, in part because of the Federation's 10th anniversary celebration, and that's is held in Beijing at the same time. And so, of course, it's very kind of potently symbolic. And also that's, I have a section on it at the end of the chapter that covers, as you say, that roughly 10-year span from 46 to 56. Actually, though, 1952, the Executive Council meeting that was held in Vienna, to kind of add to the dates and places and that you were mentioning. But actually, it's because it's precisely that I think that period that you were mentioning is hugely important, where the Federation itself is frankly in a point of crisis, an existential crisis. The British and French governments are in particular trying to kind of squeeze it, and that meeting just of its kind of top brass is prevented from happening in a few different ways, and as I say, it eventually ends up going ahead in Vienna. But one of the reasons that it goes ahead is because of Chinese intervention, because they step in and pay their fees, affiliation fees, in advance, which allows basically the funding to let the meeting go ahead and for people to move. One of the reasons, you know, I see that as quite a significant moment is showing, well, look, this is a very active and important intervention. But also it's hugely significant in terms of how the Federation itself will then evolve, because that's the meeting at which greenlights the entry of affiliated organizations from Hungary, from Poland, and most of course, importantly, of course, the Soviet Union. And so this sets in motion some really big shifts within the organization. And ones, ironically enough, that in the longer term would become an issue for China come the breakdown of the Sino-Soviet alliance. But again, you know, the two things being here that one, China and Chinese scientists in particular are involved from the get-go, whereas at least formally the Soviets aren't. But also that, as I say, they play a kind of facilitation role, I think is kind of hugely important, especially in how the MFA and other actors are kind of viewing their engagement.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, the funding, that's something that comes up at numerous points throughout this book in terms of, you know, the vast amounts of money that are being spent on these different engagements or sponsoring conferences or, you know, hosting conferences. There's quite a bit of money involved, and that sort of just sort of lends itself, you know, as support or backing behind the point that, you know, the CCP is taking these events very seriously. There's great investment in them.
Well, and I think even just supporting the mobility of those scientists who are attending them, right? It's time consuming and expensive to travel at these stages. And so, there's a lot of logistics that goes into making it happen.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of, you know, logistics and travel, I do want to make sure we spend quite a bit of time on Pugwash. Again, personal bias.
Get back
to Canada. Yes, get back to Canada.
Happy to talk Nova Scotia.
Very rare I get to talk about Nova Scotia here. But so the Pugwash conferences, they've come up a few times. But chapter two sort of really focuses on them. And, you know, you note here again that Chinese scientists were involved in the Pugwash conferences on science and world affairs right from the beginning. And I'm actually, you know, thinking of these conferences and what they're doing. Actually, I wonder if I could back up a little and ask you to sort of just touch on, you know, what the goal of these conferences were, the Pugwash conferences in particular. You know, what were they doing as a sort of conference before we talk a little bit about Chinese involvement? So what was Pugwash? Why did it happen?
Pugwash? Well, again, oh, that we could be talking for an hour and a half and about what was or what is Pugwash, because it is a fascinatingly complex thing. But at its most basic terms, Pugwash was envisaged as a way of getting scientists together with this notion that scientists could speak a common language, that being science, with interest. It started off being really focused on anti-nuclear activism in terms of proliferation. It came out of something called the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, and which again features a little bit in the chapter in terms of how even the organizers of the manifesto were thinking about having Chinese involvement, even if that in that particular case fell through. And the idea was to bring scientists from across the Cold War divides, across the blocks, to really kind of talk in a frank and open way, and ultimately to potentially influence their governments and policy making and that kind of thing in a way that might help avert nuclear catastrophe.
Yeah, no, thank you for setting that up. So with that context, let's touch on the person who was sent from China or invited, maybe. So much of this chapter looks at the Chinese scientist who attended the first conference, and then a few others, and finally the last one, or at least the last one for which there was Chinese involvement in 1960, which, as you note, was the last Pugwash event to have Chinese involvement for the next 25 years. So there's incredible, you know, tense negotiations going on in the background about who is going to attend these events. And your chapter really examines the tensions between individual scientists and the PRC party state in shaping and establishing what Chinese engagement with, you know, what you just sort of set up so beautifully, the goals of Pugwash were. And what really struck me was, you know, the degree of influence particular scientists were able to have. And I'm thinking here in particular of Zhou Peiyuan, the scientist who attended the early Pugwash conferences. So could you tell us about him? What did he do at the, you know, early, what did he do in general, but what did he do at the early Pugwash conferences? And, you know, what do you make of him as a, you know, an agent of PRC science diplomacy?
Well, if we're going to talk about Zhou Peiyuan, I feel like the person I have to quote is Mary Brown Bullock. And I actually do so in the book because I feel like her formulation just encapsulates it perfectly. Also, she knew him and she described him as China's scientist diplomat par excellence. And I couldn't put it better because, I mean, this is very much a kind of lifelong activity. It's worth, you know, keeping in mind that when we're talking about that 25-year absence from Pugwash, Zhou Peiyuan is at the leading the delegation when China comes back. And he's involved in the 1990s when China plays host just before his death. He's really a kind of properly lifelong Pugwashite. And in some ways, I think he kind of perfectly encapsulates the tension, because when you're looking at the sources and hearing people talk about him from the Pugwash contest, that they will talk about, oh, Zhou Peiyuan's our man in Beijing, right? Whereas in Beijing, he's very much he's our man in Pugwash, and he, along with the constellation, and he's probably, I'd say, the kind of main character in the book, if there is one, but along with Zhu Kezhen, the meteorologist, Qian Xianqiang and Li Siguang are kind of the quartet of scientists who focus on this. Now, Zhou Peiyuan is kind of well-suited disciplinarily to being at something like Pugwash. He's a theoretical physicist, so he kind of fits in with a lot of the very physics-dominated crowd that's at the very first Pugwash conferences. But really, the reasons that he's kind of selected, and he is selected to go on the Chinese side, is less some of those that specialization, but more the kind of interpersonal things, the ways that his networks have evolved, how well connected, how well known, and how well respected he is. He's a brilliant scientist. He'd spent years studying and also working in the United States, also Western Europe. He'd been at the Institute of Advanced Study for a year with Albert Einstein, and he was able to kind of draw very effectively on that background when interacting with others. He's always consistently described as kind of very well-spoken and urbane and able to kind of talk about, you know, his favorite diners when he was a student and things like that, which, you know, play a big role in helping kind of him connect on a variety of levels with the others who are at these events.
Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite moments in this chapter is where you're discussing, you know, he does not mention in his official reports his time reminiscing about Chicago, but it's clear from sort of other reports, you know, outside of China that happened as well. The sort of the personal connection that is so important, you know, alongside the science that's happening and able to happen at these conferences, especially the early ones when he is alone, when he's the one representative sort of on his own able to talk about Chicago.
And that's really striking, the fact that he's trusted enough to go alone. Mm-hmm. He's not accompanied by a translator. He's not got other members of the delegation, anybody looking over his shoulder. So it is interesting the extent to which he is, you know, his reports back are a key bit of kind of shaping thinking and discourse in terms of how he narrates and steers the relationship with the organization.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned sort of steering, actually. I'll pick up on that, because that's sort of a continual tension, I suppose, in China's involvement with these conferences. China's continually trying to sort of steer things, or trying to work out how it can best steer things, if I can sort of put it like that. And you get over the course of the chapter sort of different attempts to sort of, you know, figure out where China best sits, and different attempts to sort of figure out different ways in which China can steer things. And as we touched on a little bit, by 1960, the PRC has really decided to sort of move away from pugwash. it's not really working out the way that they want to, in part because of very tense interactions with Soviet scientists, the 1960 pugwash conference. But the World Federation of Scientific Workers is seen as having a little bit more potential, particularly in the fight against imperialism. So they decide to sort of try this a little bit more. And that's where Chapter 3 takes us. But in Chapter 3, we sort of see the impact of China's increasingly radical 1960s foreign relations on the international activities of Chinese scientists. But there's, you know, even more involvement from Chinese scientists in WFSW leadership, greater involvement in the Federation's magazine, and throughout, you know, CCP foreign policymakers are attempting to use the Federation to their own ends. But things really change with the Sino-Soviet split. So this is books have been written and will continue to be written on the Sino-Soviet split, but here... how did it impact the involvement of Chinese scientists in the WFSW? Sort of focusing on this very small thing, how does the Sino-Soviet split manifest here?
Well, I mean, as you point out, it manifests, across, just as there's been books in terms of debating when did the Sino-Soviet split, you know, start and when do we debate it. I think, you know, that fits very nicely into the muddied water there, because, you know, the tensions are evident even from the late 50s in some ways in both organizations, Pugwash and the World Federation. We see this interesting bit where they basically, again, that central dynamic that I mentioned that kind of comes up in Chapter 1, the fact that China was there at the very beginning in the World Federation compared to Pugwash, where the Soviets are much more entrenched, or at least are, you know, perceived to be by Chinese foreign policymakers. And so there's the strategic pivot to go, well, let's go toward the organization where we think we have more traction and we have more sympathy. And as you say, there are efforts, but the thing is the extent to which, as in many other international organizations, scientific and otherwise, in which both the Soviets and the Chinese are involved in the mid 60s, meetings are getting derailed by rival motions and attempts to disrupt and to kind of wrest control from each other in some fairly colorful episodes that, again, I think really, to come back to what we were talking about earlier, that kind of really put the scientists who are having to enact these under a considerable amount of strain. The kind of tightrope that they're walking and the pivots that they're having to undertake are quite challenging for them. And what that ultimately results in, though, is a decision to kind of, on their way out of the World Federation, to do their own thing. this forum isn't working for us, so we're going to find something else. But before we do, we're going to piggyback onto that, whether they want it or not, are the kind of this sowing the seeds of our own initiative, which would kind of come to fruition in the Peking Science Symposium conferences starting in 1964. And that is in some respects the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of relations, although they do kind of limp on for a few more years in the 60s. But about 63, 64 becomes a major pivot point.
One of my favorite lines in this chapter was you're talking about the sort of the falling out, if you will. And you have this great line: China was on its way out, but it was not going to do so without making a great deal of noise in the process. And that just made me laugh because you also have some really interesting, talking about the tension and the immense sort of the difficult position scientists were placed under. You have some really interesting, very polemical speeches that you quote from extensively here in discussing, just how tense these meetings were, just how tense these general assemblies were. There's some harsh words being said.
There are, and then at the same time, kind of less harsh discussions happening between friends, outside of the official forums, and then also things becoming very difficult for those who are most sympathetic to or who are the longest term friends or colleagues and supporters of the Chinese representatives who are kind of trying to massage the relationship, just ultimately proves too difficult.
Mm-hmm. So they've tried pugwash. They've tried the World Federation of Scientific Workers. And then, as you say, they try the Peking Science Symposiums. And this is the focus of chapter 4. We touched on a little bit the amounts of money that were being spent. So these were two science symposiums in 1964 and 1966. And touching on funding, these were expensive, complicated events. They're really actively trying here to bring regional allies together. They were designed to bring scientists from the developing world together. And I just want to just throw out the numbers because they're really interesting in thinking about how China is or isn't, interconnected with the outside world during this period. 367 scientists from 44 countries took part in the 1964 symposium, and 144 scientists from 33 countries took part in the 1966 colloquium. So these are, really culminations of long-held ambitions of the CCP to bring scientists to the PRC. And they're really hoping through these to promote regional solidarity. So touching on, you mentioned before, those sympathetic or those a little bit friendly to the PRC, they're really trying to bring those people together and promote regional solidarity. So how did they try to do that in these events? What were some of the things that they tried, and how would you say it went? How were those, were those goals met or not so much?
Well, so that, it's a tricky question because I think the answer is both yes and no at the same time. In some ways, it partly, I think, speaks to, in some ways, the diversity of the attendees at both of these events. And of course, one of the other reasons I was really interested in them is the 1964 event. It's the biggest international science meeting that the PRC hosts up to that point. And of course, that dynamic is absolutely crucial that you highlight, right? Is the exclusion of who's not invited. I endlessly entertained by the fact that because Oceania was included, that there were a couple of random Australians and New Zealanders who tagged along, but otherwise Central and Eastern Europe not invited, North America outside of Mexico, for example, but that basically there was a conscious attempt to exclude the kind of good chunks of the socialist and also the so-called Western worlds. I think So to start off with the strategies, right, there's a mixture of, I mean, there's a whole bunch of infrastructure that's put in place. In terms of the actual science that's going on, these are such large events and they're so broad. Even the physics colloquium in 66 is so broad that I don't know how... I'd be hesitant to say there was a huge amount of depth to the material. That said, you know, you do see, for example, some citations in later work of papers that people presented there. So it's, I don't, this is again where that interesting tension between kind of the exchange and propaganda is, because that is happening and I should say there is the scientific exchange happening, but at the same time, kind of placed all around it, beyond who's invited, of course, are invitations to rallies. And in 66, you know, more interest in, of course, in this cultural revolution thing that seems to be coming together, because it's in August of 66. So it's a really kind of fascinating moment when it's being held. Of course, discussions about, you know, going back to your question in terms of the promoting regional solidarity, there's a lot of Vietnam related content that China is pushing, and of course in each of the cases, and one of the interesting dynamics is the fact that the Japanese contingents are at both, you know, some of the largest in terms of national groupings coming over. So there's clearly an awful lot happening, and again, I think it's potentially a mixed bag in the short term, and certainly, you know, that these had been envisaged as happening every 2 years. So 64, there, you know, is a big multidisciplinary event. 66 is physics. Then it was supposed to go back in 68 to a big multidisciplinary one. Obviously, they didn't continue. However, you know, people who attended these meetings did later in life travel back to China and have experiences there that kind of shaped and formed them. So I'd say, you know, potentially, actually, if you look at this in a longer lens, it's potentially a greater influence than might be first thought.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And you were touching on there the tension between, you know, exchange and propaganda. And that, for me, at least, came through, I guess, most obviously, or maybe most clearly, in sort of the after conference events. You have a great discussion of sort of, you know, the cultural tours that some of the delegates were going on. So you know, you described one group of Japanese delegates who, you know, they went to, if I can remember correctly, they went to see a commune, they went to a study seminar on Mao Zedong thought, they went to see a children's recreation center, and then, you know, heavy machinery, and then an 8-model play. So a real mix of everything sort of all at once.
Absolutely. And that in some ways is where this ties in, to go back to the other aspect of the United Front work and some of the kind of wider outreach among the global left. You know, all of those things you've just described, of course, are, and also the places they were visiting, are kind of would be familiar ones to other visitors who would come, who are non-scientific. So you know, it's again, there's this interesting tension between scientists as a kind of distinct category, but also within a broader spectrum of activities.
So speaking of visitors, so this brings us to, as I promised at the very beginning, chapter 5. And this chapter looks at 5 British visitors, all of them sympathetic to China, or at least with very left-wing political views. And there are, you know, each of the 5 scientists that you focus on here are so different. And you make a point in this chapter very clearly of saying that, you know, trying to group them together in terms of what they were doing or what they were thinking or what they wanted from it, you know, any way you try to group them really does sort of run the risk of oversimplifying each individual. But one thing that does link them, and I will note, they're all fascinating and they're just really interesting people and really interesting lives. But one thing that does link them is the existence and importance of connection. So you note that each of them had sort of a direct relationship with, you know, someone or colleagues or friends, or they knew someone who knew someone. And some of these, you know, predated 1949. But thinking about connections. So could you explain maybe, you know, with one or two examples, the importance of connections to these scientists and, you know, more broadly, why is this sort of important? Thinking about, you know, the we see these connections, how do they matter in terms of how we think about science in this period, or, you know, China's place in the international world? Why is the connection so important here?
So I think, personal connections are a real personal and professional, and in the way those bleed together, right, are incredibly important in this chapter. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to include it, just to showcase that I think individuals, a lot of this book, you know, the previous chapter was thinking partly about the, you know, structures, domestic structures, down to, you know, what's the role of local scientific organizations in hosting duties of these symposia. And I think I was really keen not to lose the individuals, because for those who were making these journeys in either direction, it was the individuals and those relationships that really mattered. And I think it's because, you know, to, I guess I'm a child of the internationalization generation in terms of China scholarship, in terms of seeing that longer term impact, right, of internationalization in terms of science, you know, that so often, again, is pointed to the Boxer Indemnity Scholarship Program, for example, which, of course, didn't just happen in the United, case of the United States, but also the United Kingdom, right? And so one of the points I'm kind of trying to make about, in a sense, Chinese scientists and Chinese science through this chapter is the extent to which the scientists who feature this here are well connected and, very crucially, also well respected by their colleagues, right? The British scientists, or British based, maybe more accurately, scientists who I'm talking about in this chapter are all kind of very well known in their field, in some cases more notorious than others for their political views. But, you know, they're very good in laboratory and very well respected for that. I mean, maybe one example I might point to, so one of the scientists I talk about is Kathleen Lonsdale, the crystallographer, and, you know, alongside the really quite pioneering work she's doing as a scientist and in the lab, she's of course a Quaker and a very passionate peace activist, and so again with the blurring of activities, her trip to China is in 1955 is part of a big goodwill mission, right? She's the only scientist in that group. But what's really notable in her case is the fact that she gets fed up with the main itinerary, doing those types of visits that you described happening in 66. And as a result, her host let her go off and basically do her own thing and start to visit universities and research institutes and labs, right? She wants to connect with scientists. And again, in terms of the relationships, she's in some ways the odd one out of the group in this chapter, because she doesn't have the same strength of direct relationships, but she still, for example, ends up meeting Huang Kun, who had published the previous year a book with her friend Max Born, and they spent some time visiting, and she knew Dorothy Hodgkin and Desmond Bernal and others who all did have very close friends and networks, and who kind of said, look up so-and-so, talk to them, you know, that you'll have a great conversation with them. And then also is trying to facilitate, and again, you see Zhou Peiwen discreetly doing this the other way around, incidentally, at Pugwash, right? Trying to facilitate communication back the other way, and take up messages, and even Lonsdale trying to do things like fill gaps in journal holdings at institutions that she sees, send off prints, and that kind of thing. But one of the other reasons that I love Kathleen Lonsdale as an example in the chapter, is where she kind of is the exception that proves the rule in her insistence in not wanting to portray herself as a China expert, which is very rare. And so she'll very happily, you know, she tells people, oh, I'll circulate my notes with you and stuff like that. But I don't want to get up and talk publicly about this. Thank you very much. I don't know enough. Which again is a comparatively rare thing for the scientists and frankly plenty of other visitors at the time.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about your description of her and her sort of reaction to what's going on is her, I suppose, her observation, this is not entirely related to the chapter, but I just thought it was so interesting. Her observation that the length of her talk varied depending on who was translating her, which I would have loved to, you know, it's sort of just mentioned here as her sort of like, huh, interesting. But you talk about how her talks, you know, vary, you know, from an hour to sort of over 4 hours. Even though her talk didn't change, it was just the way in which she was being translated and, you know, whether or not someone was adding or, you know, giving context or commentating or what was going on with her translators, that her talks could vary so very much.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, just as an aside, one of the reasons that I was interested in that commentary of hers and also some of these other experiences is that, unlike Joseph Needham, so this is one of the other reasons that I wrote the chapter, he appears in the background in a few places, and there's a bit of a 6 degrees of separation thing going on here in terms of there's usually a connection that you can find somewhere. But just to make the point that he wasn't the only one going over, and of course his experience in some ways was exceptional because he had a greater awareness of what people were saying around him and an ability to kind of interact during this period. Whereas, of course, these other visitors were very much kind of subject to the translators. And in many of these cases with those talks, those translators were people based at the local institution, either students or staff who had a base level of knowledge to be able to translate often fairly technical talks, right? This is one of the things that in the previous chapter comes up is the importance of, okay, we have to train up a bunch of these translators to work at this science conference because it's a very broad set of very specific types of language that's going to be used.
Yeah, it's definitely, I guess, running in the background a little bit here, the need to, this is again, personal, much more of something that I appreciate from my own sort of background and interests here, but there's definitely the importance of translators it's definitely in the background. But I want to make sure we have a little bit of time, you know, putting what I am personally interested in aside, I want to make sure we have time to talk about the conclusion. So the conclusion really speaks to, you know, the consequences or, you know, of the insights of the book. So there's a few things it touches on. It looks at how we might think of international science during the Cold War period and China's place within it, now that we have, you know, a different sense of China's scientific outreach. It touches on, you know, the fact that there are these continuities between the state-sponsored international activities of the Mao period and those under Deng Xiaoping. You know, so looking across and making it very clear that there is an across the 1978 divide. And finally, it touches on, you know, the long-term importance of the approach of the CCP towards science diplomacy, keeping in mind China's, you know, rise as a science and technology superpower. So there's a lot in the conclusion, and it really does do a great job of summarizing everything and, you know, putting it all together. But is there one part of it that you would like to highlight here? Maybe something we haven't really had a chance to talk too much about.
So I guess, I mean, possibly to kind of come back to the piece of jargon in terms of thinking about the now and the present day. And it's that term science diplomacy, which is anachronistic, right, in how I deploy it. And I do try and make that clear in the introduction. But the reason for doing so, and the reason why I think maybe it's we worth mentioning this, right, is because One of the interesting things that you see when talking about China now and its influence, right, is it's increasingly entering these discourses, and science diplomacy discourses are kind of practitioner orient originating, and then academics have kind of taken them on since, and so that adds a certain degree of messiness to it in terms of how that they're proposed. But I think one of the motivations for the chapter and for really using the term was to kind of address, okay, well, let's be careful when we're using this term science diplomacy, because there's attempts to draw kind of through lines back through time and to say, okay, this is distinct, this is different from, say, what the United States or the United Kingdom is doing, for example, and why is there? And I think there's a dangerous impulse to potentially essentialize, right, and to go maybe a bit too far back or do particular types of things. And so one of the things that, the conclusion tries to do, that I think is, I hope that the book tries to do, is to show that, okay, no, again, things didn't magically appear in the 70s, right? And then, oh, just shoot off, that there's kind of foundations that have been laid beforehand. But at the same time, those foundations come in a variety of different ways, whether it's internationalization in the early 20th century, or again, United Front work and these kinds of things, the kind of longer bits of continuities. And so those, to me, when talking and thinking about, again, science diplomacy, whatever that may be in terms of China, that those are some of the things that I think we possibly need to be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, it really is, conclusions do many different things in general, but this one I found to be particularly effective in that it sort of brought all of that, all of what you touched on, and much more together.
It, let's just say it went through a few drafts. So that is very reassuring.
As is the way of conclusions.
Indeed.
But now that you're finished with those drafts, now that the mm-hmm. book exists in its final form, never say never, but now that it exists in its final form, what are you working on now? What are you working on next? This is the way of academia. Now that you're done with this, what is the next big thing that you're working on, Gordon?
Well, I've got a few different things in the fire. I mean, one of the things, again, I think this is a fairly typical story, right, is this started life as a dissertation. And then I needed to step away from that dissertation for a little while and was very excited to get, kind of other things moving, and then had kind of come back to it. One of the things I'm working on, there's a thread here where it really struck me when I was doing this research, a number of psychologists who were involved in the Chinese Association of Scientific Workers, people like Pan Shu. And so one of the things I've been working on that is turned into, thanks to the pandemic, I think it's evolving into a longer term project, is on psychiatry and psychology in the early PRC periods, and kind of the science medicine boundary and disciplinarity, but also thinking more broadly about region, again, when it comes to some of this foreign relations stuff. I'm a postdoctoral researcher on a project about the history of data diplomacy, and so I've been actually revisiting, which is where the book opens, the International Geophysical Year and China's non-participation in that, I'm looking at a variety of issues centering around the IGY and also some other aspects of exchange in the early 50s that kind of takes things in different directions and is thinking about, again, questions of identity how networks functioned in different contexts.
Mm-hmm. So definitely some through lines there in terms of, the networks, the connections, the importance of them. Well, my very best of luck and sources, I suppose. I wish good sources and good access upon you as you embark on those projects, moving away from crystallographers and nuclear scientists to psychologists. It sounds like a fascinating project. Best of luck with that. And thank you for taking the time in talking with me about this project, though.
Again, thank you very much for having me.